Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 9 of the official Cyblogs podcast. Once again, I'm joined by Calvin Baxter this week. I'm Amy Woodcroft, because Elf is still away. We're hoping to have him back next week, should he not have been taken out by any pirates. So welcome, Calvin.
Hello.
Diving straight in this week, what are we looking at first?
Oh, we're looking at tearing the universe a new hole.
We are
with
indeed.
Lasers.
Yeah, yeah.
Always with the lasers on this show. Do you always have laser stories, or is it just while I'm here?
Whenever possible. Lasers and spaceships are good. We like them. But this is really interesting. So I'm sure everybody remembers when they started up the Large Hadron Collider a couple of years back. People were like, mini black holes, they're going to rip apart the fabric of space-time. Disaster, disaster. Well, some scientists are actually going to do that now on purpose. Calvin, want to tell us a bit more about it?
Well, yeah, they're just going to take a bunch of very, very powerful lasers, 10 of them, and fire them all into the very, very, very small space using a huge amount of energy for a very short amount of time. I think you've got some figures on just how much energy they're going to use.
We do. It's 200 petawatts. Now, for people who don't think in that amount of number, the world's energy consumption at the moment is sitting at about 15 terawatts. 200 petawatts is a little bit more than 100,000 times that amount. So, but it's one trillionth of a second?
It's in the realms of a trillionth of a second.
So, yeah, but 100,000 times the world's annual energy consumption. Yes, less than a trillionth of a second. It's fairly impressive. And why are they doing this?
In the hope, basically, that they'll tear apart space-time and get a chance to have a look at what comes out.
Indeed. We'll point you guys to the link on the whole article should you want to get to know a lot more about this. But the whole idea is basically that they're looking for what they call ghost particles, which is basically the idea is that at the very fundamental levels of space, particles pop in and out of existence all the time, and they borrow little bits of energy to do that, and then sort of give that energy back when they annihilate each other and pass out of existence again. And the idea is that this laser could hold them apart for enough time for them to be detected, which is a pretty cool idea.
And this is the physics that goes on just basically on the surface just outside the singularity of a black hole.
Yeah.
This is Hawking radiation.
Absolutely.
That we're talking about here.
Really interesting stuff. So they've got the prototype lasers are now being built in the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Romania. And the idea is to see them commissioned in 2015. So there's going to be a lot of excitement about that. But I imagine a lot of people as well sort of
What could possibly go wrong with firing 10 incredibly powerful lasers all in one spot in the hope of tearing a hole in space-time?
Indeed.
Of course. Well, whatever can go wrong, it's going to be interesting.
Absolutely. And you know, if it becomes Cthulhu and the Elder Gods, we're okay. We're prepared for that.
Absolutely.
Bring them on.
Yeah, bring them on.
Right, well, moving on to something slightly more prosaic, but nonetheless pretty cool. Boeing, in fact, has set up what they're calling the Orbiter Processing Facility 3 at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and they're going to be manufacturing a crew transport spacecraft, the idea being that it'll launch to the International Space Station. So Boeing is now providing space planes, kind of thing.
Yeah, and am I allowed to say, colour me unimpressed? It doesn't really, you know, look like much beyond what they were putting up 40 years ago.
No.
I'm very unimpressed with the American attitude to space since they got bored with it.
Yes, it is very sad.
And they tend to put very long timescales on doing really quite unimaginative and unambitious things.
Well, yeah, after the heyday of the 60s and 70s, it just feels like they ran out of energy, and so
yeah.
now it's limping along. Nonetheless, though, these CST-100s, as they're called, apparently it's going to create several hundred jobs, which is always nice, particularly in the space industry, where I get the impression they're mostly losing jobs.
Mm.
They will carry, I'm just looking at the stats here, they said, I think they can carry 7 people. So, yes, the idea will be they'll be the new ferry, or one of the new ferries between the ISS, since NASA decommissioned all of the shuttles, so NASA now is no longer able to shuttle people back and forth.
Backwards and forwards.
Which seems unfortunate. We'll see. We'll be watching. But, you know, well done, Boeing, for getting in there when apparently nobody else was. Cool. All right. Calvin, what have we got up next?
You'll have to wait for me to press the next button on my browser, won't you? Oh, this is an excellent story. How much do you think the internet weighs?
I don't know. Lots or nothing. Depending on how you measure it.
Well, do you know how much the internet weighs in strawberries? They're the SI unit for weight of the data.
I'd like to say a punnet, just because the word amuses me.
It's less than a punnet. It's a fraction of a punnet. It's approximately, depending on how you measure it, if you're just talking about the information on the internet itself, it's about a strawberry.
Fantastic.
But if you're talking about all the information held on the computers that are attached to the internet, not just the servers, it's possibly up to 5 strawberries.
My God. The horror. Now, all of this comes from a really interesting video, which again we'll link to. Always go and look at cyblogs.co.nz/TOSP, where we put the links for each episode as it goes up. But this is a really interesting video. How much does the internet weigh? And this gentleman talks about the different ways of measuring it. So as Calvin's just taken you through the strawberry measurement, which is a fascinating way to do things. But he also looks at some other ways to measure it, which end up at an unimaginably small number.
Mm, basically, it's just looking at the number of electrons involved in the entire process. It started out on trying to work out how much additional mass was gained on a Kindle if you loaded it up with books, which worked out to be trillions of times smaller than our most sensitive scale.
Mm, which makes sense. I mean, you don't ever have to worry that your pockets are going to be heavier because you chucked on some extra books onto your e-reader.
Well, it's actually millions of times heavier if you charge the battery up. Mm. I don't mean that millions of times heavier. And this just goes to show how you can mess with statistics. I don't mean to say it's millions of times heavier than a single Kindle, but there are millions of times more weight by the energy in the battery than the data stored.
Fascinating. I'd never even considered that, you know, charging a battery might make it
more massive.
It is so slightly heavier. It's a fantastic concept. So, yeah, go and have a look at the video. It's certainly food for thought. I have had a couple of people say to me, but what about all the hardware associated with the internet? But there's possibly the argument to be made there that that's not the internet, that's the support structures of the internet.
Yes.
The internet is the information contained within all of these.
Yeah, well, those support structures are constantly changing.
Exactly.
Those servers are getting more powerful, more numerous, taking less energy per process, doing more processes per second all the time. It's fluid. And the computing platform that it's on can be changing. I mean, it wouldn't be a very fast internet, but this could all run on valves.
Just about, yeah.
Giant, massive rooms, factories full of valve-powered computers.
Amazing.
Admittedly, it would be a small version of the internet, but, you know.
But it would be a version of it, a version, sort of alpha.
But would that be a lighter internet because it had less electrons involved in it?
There you go.
Oh.
Although it may be a heavier
internet because valves would have a lot of valves, not just the valves themselves, but all the electrons flowing around between the plates on the valves would number more valves per more electrons per transistor effect going on.
Oh my. So a fun story, certainly something to go and ask your friends, see what they think. I think the funniest thing I've seen about around this quantification of the internet was somebody was required by their maths or economics professor to come up with the value of the internet. Said student posted the question on the internet, at which, you know, boing boing or whatever it was, everybody went berserk over answering it. But the best answer I ever saw was the internet costs one internet. Or is worth one internet. And it was an engineer who came up with it, and it was all that, you know, you need to pick your metrics. You
know what I mean? it's like the answer to the question of, you know, what's the probability of life arising from a primordial soup? it's one.
Mm.
We're here. It happened.
Clearly.
That is the probability.
Absolutely. So, good stuff. Fun things to think about. Now, in other news, we like to follow the LHC because it's a wonderful, wonderful machine. And the Higgs boson, we do not say God particle. We think it's a terrible word for it.
In fact, we shouldn't even say that we don't say it.
You're right, we shouldn't.
What don't we say?
Nothing.
We don't say nothing.
The Higgs boson.
The first rule of the Higgs boson, don't mention...
the other phrasing.
The other phrasing. So the Higgs boson hasn't been found yet.
No, which has a lot of scientists very unhappy, although it's not necessarily surprising. I mean... apparently, the number of places to look for it are steadily diminishing, which is freaking people out a bit.
However, they have been looking for it in the less likely places first.
Fair enough. Ah, I didn't know that.
Apparently, the energy levels that they've got to look at, the remaining energy levels for next year are lower energy levels, therefore harder to detect. So
right.
They've been looking at the easy ones first.
Ah, okay.
But they reckon it's more likely that the detection range is in the lower levels.
Absolutely. So the news here is that the LHC has announced that they've wrapped up, for at least for this year, so a couple of months early, any of the experiments which might have shown any glimpses of the Higgs boson. We won't get into... We're assuming our listeners probably know something about the Higgs boson, so we're not going to get into trying to explain it
very
much. Go and look it up. It's fascinating stuff. It's one of the big mysteries at the moment.
What is interesting now is you're going to get a possible coincidence of the sensible scientific people at the LHC doing experiments to try and find the Higgs boson. Really important thing. In the year 2012, where all the nutters are expecting something nutty to happen.
Oh, dear. Well, oh goodness. And they're going to be building lasers that rip apart the universe. So this is going to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but there's also, of course, it needs to be borne in mind that the LHC is producing truly gobsmacking amounts of data as well. So even if it's not running or not running certain experiments, it doesn't mean that, you know, there's nothing
I think that there's a little bit of a misconception that the LHC simply exists to prove or disprove one particular theory about the Higgs boson. And it's there for research. It's there to find things out, not to prove or disprove. It's there to do science.
Yeah, and it's doing the most... Yeah, it's just producing the most astonishing amount of data. So there are, I'm sure, scads of PhDs being written and will be written just for years over... analyzing everything that's being generated at the moment. Again, we'll be keeping track of this one and seeing what happens, but it doesn't look like we'll be hearing about any Higgs bosons for Christmas.
Oh, there goes my Christmas present.
There goes my Christmas present, too. Oh, well. Kelvin, do you want to lead us into
temptation, yes. Lead us into the future, into immortality.
Something like that.
Let us all live forever. Which I'm all for.
Yeah, very much so.
I don't have any real gripes with that. I think it's a perfectly fine idea. And basically some scientists from the German Cancer Research Center have discovered an alternative mechanism for extending the telomerase sequence at the end of DNA. Which is basically an easy way of thinking of this is the burning fuse towards cell senescence and death.
Exactly. So at the ends of your DNA are these things called telomeres, and with each round of replication, that those telomeres shorten. So
yes.
Exactly like fuses, and when they get to a certain length, the cell offs itself because it's old. Now, in some cancer cells, this is one of the things that can get disrupted, which causes cells to go cancerous because they don't have any sort of break on them anymore, particularly if they're sick cells. So they just go wild. But there's and so one of the ways to lengthen telomeres is with an enzyme called telomerase, which is present, for example, in very young people, very young organisms, but generally gets shut down into adulthood. But
so we should eat the young.
Yeah. Well, no, I did not say yes. Like to be clear. And there has been work looking into what if we reacted telomerase, but there's the sort of the scariness about it, well, making cancerous cells and things like that. This is very necessary that cells die, well, at least to some extent, before we've got a handle on it. But there's another way that it happens, that without telomerase. And basically, they've been looking at some tumor cells, and they've got, I won't go into the details, but they've got little protein groups on the end of the telomeres, and it looks like they activate a cell repair, a DNA repair sequence. So the cell comes in and rebuilds the telomere as if it were damaged DNA, as opposed to a fuse.
So they add to it rather than take away?
Something like that. Or certainly, I don't know if they add to it, but they certainly stop it degrading any further and stop the cells dying. So this is obviously of use for, of great interest for cancer research, because the idea is if that can be disrupted, then the cells can die and the cancer can go away, which would be nice.
So yet another possible line on cancer cures, mm-hmm. of which have been loads lately, and yet another possible line on living longer, of which have been loads lately.
Yeah.
Although, let's face it, you know, most people reckon we're not going to live forever because Aubrey de Grey has a ridiculous beard.
It's true. Anybody who doesn't know who Aubrey de Grey is, he is an English author and a theoretician in the field of gerontology. So that's the study of aging?
Yes. And he is. He's one of the leading lights in this. He's a very, very clever guy. He also has
a ridiculous
facial topiary.
Yeah, it's a truly astonishing beard. But Calvin and I were talking about it earlier, is these sort of genius-like people who generally have a couple of eccentricities about them, whether it's personal beliefs on vitamin use or amazing facial topiary. That tends to get them discounted by a lot of people simply for one aspect of
their personality, of their quirkiness.
Mm.
And yeah, people go on to discount their theories or their thoughts or their ideas because of that. It's a terrible ad hominem argument going on.
And it seems a bit strange that nobody realizes that, you know, really, really smart people are probably going to have a couple of quirks. Makes
really?
I don't know. I'm just guessing.
They all seem so balanced to me.
So normal. Yes, well, so there's that. Hooray for potentially at some point living for longer. We'll probably at some point devote an entire podcast episode to topics like this because they're quite fun to get into. But moving along, this is quite cool. Hooray for the Australian scientists. In fact, scientists from QUT, which is the Queensland University of Technology, they've developed a new material for cleaning up contaminated water from radioactive leaks and medical processes. It's pretty cool, actually. So they've mixed titanate nanofiber and nanotubes into a powder. And apparently, if you put this powder into a ton of water, let's say a gram of it, into a ton of water.
Literally a ton of water, not just a euphemism for a lot of water.
You are absolutely correct, because I do use a ton quite a lot just to mean lots. Literally a ton of water. And you make sure it's properly distributed and things like that. Apparently, it can de-radioactivize, that's me making up a new word, the water.
That's a really cool word.
I know, right? The nanotubes are coated in, they say, silver oxide nanocrystals, and apparently they hold and fix radioactive iodine ions. Now, iodine ions are some of the really scary ones with radioactive leaks or processes.
So would this become, keeping things obviously very sensible for cyborgs here, would this become a generic kind of kryptonite for all superheroes who derive their powers from a nuclear source, like a radioactive spider bite?
Oh,
could you strip Spider-Man of his powers with mixed titanate nanofibers?
I mean, it's an interesting question to get into, but one would probably argue that he was radioactive only very briefly while it damaged his DNA, but thereafter he's no longer radioactive.
So
there's not much to clean up. But I don't know, we have yet to get a blood sample from the man.
Or radioactive man from The Simpsons.
Well, true. Certainly something to bear in mind. On the serious side, something like this couldn't be used for accidents such as Fukushima.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Unfortunately, but it does. It could be used in a number of other processes and leaks and things. And Australia stands to be the leader.
And also to help keep the coolant clean in nuclear technology.
Of course, yes. That's brilliant. And you know, the more we're able to deal with radioactivity, perhaps the less people will be scared by nuclear power, which may not be a bad thing. We'll see. Right. Our next one, we've got some more NASA goodness, because NASA's awesome. Well, sometimes. We had just been bashing
NASA
them.
NASA can be awesome.
They can be awesome. This one's about asteroids. And I'm going to ask if Kelvin wants to start talking about it, or whether I will.
I think you should, because my article has disappeared from my screen.
Fair enough. All right, but this is just a quick one. There's an asteroid flyby on November 8th.
What's its number?
YU55.
Why you know 55?
Oh dear.
I'm sorry.
We've had too much sugar. We apologize profusely. So there's the asteroid 2005 YU55. I can't stop giggling. And it's going to be passing the Earth, but slightly closer than the Moon.
Yes.
On November 8th. It's still a fair...
And it's quite big. It's, 400 meters?
400 meters, yeah. 1,300 foot wide. So
I wouldn't like that to land on my little country.
No. Well, it wouldn't be your country for very much longer.
No.
No. But don't panic, anybody. Nobody's expecting this to suddenly veer off course and crash into the Earth.
No, the laws of physics are quite immutable on that
they
one.
They really, really are. The number here is it will be no closer than 324,600 kilometers.
Whew.
So... we've got some wiggle room there. I would not be hitting the shelters quite yet. But pretty cool. They're going to be aiming all kinds of instrumentation at it, including some very interesting cameras. And they're hoping to get pictures or images with a resolution as fine as about 7 foot or 2 meters per pixel, which will give really nice detail of the surface.
Quite awesome.
I know, right? It's complete asteroid porn. So... I imagine it would take a couple of days for the images to be released. I don't know if they've got to do...
And then we'll have a really high, well, comparatively high resolution picture of a rock.
I know. Very exciting. But it's a space rock.
But it's, yeah.
And it's one that's been quite close. It's been at least 20 years since an asteroid was that close to us last time. I think it was in the late 70s. 76. But astronomers didn't know about it at the time. And the next known approach of an asteroid this big will be in 2028. So this is it for a while.
So what did you say? It was 2 meter resolution?
2 meters per pixel. Yeah.
And it's 400 meters?
Yeah.
So that's not that many pixels, actually. It's only going to be a web image.
That's true. But if you look, well, if we look at a lot of the images we get, they're not always so
high. Oh, I know. They're barely even that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because this is a very small piece of space.
Absolutely.
Debris here.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. Now, do we want to talk about the diffuse interstellar bands? Or do we
The self-preservation of grass.
The self-preservation of grass. Fantastic. Okay, we will move on to chat about some of these SciBlogs articles this week. This week is a slightly shorter podcast, but we think that's okay. So, Calvin, tell us about the self-preservation of grass.
Well, it's the smell of grass.
Ah.
The smell of cut grass. Is actually grass sending a message. It's telling insects to bugger off. I've got some healing to do.
Absolutely.
Essentially, I've simplified things a little bit there, but the chemical it gives off wards off insects, and which is a good thing. It means when the grass is damaged, it's keeping other forms of damage away.
Yeah, it's like chomping and things. So this was a post literally called The Self-Preservation of Grass, written by Bridget Gallagher, who is the blogger behind Digging the Dirt. Bridget often talks about sort of things archaeological, but has branched out into things grassy. I'm sorry, I don't know the word for that. So the name of the compound that we like the smell of, that sort of freshly mowed lawn smell, other than the petrol you can probably smell, is called coumarin.
Yeah.
So C-O-U-M-A-R-I-N.
Yeah, it's benzopyrone. And it's apparently commonly added to pipe tobacco and some alcoholic drinks to lure us into partaking.
I know. I was trying to think when I read that whether I've ever drunk anything that smelled like grass other than some of the Sauvignon Blancs that you can get in New Zealand. But I don't know if you're allowed to add things to wine here.
I wouldn't think so.
I wouldn't have thought so either. So I'm not sure what people are drinking, but it's certainly intriguing. I may have to go down to the local liquor store and say, Tell me about your Coumarin-infused
liquors. Yes, but our history with alcohol is a strange one. We've made every form of we put everything into alcohol that we possibly could,
this
I think,
is
as
true.
Humans.
Well, yeah.
Probably including humans.
Oh, God. Well, the occasional scrumpy vet gone horribly wrong. I mean, if you can put a sheep head in it, right? Anyway, moving along swiftly, we apologize to those of us.
Brewer listening. Falls in occasionally. Other brewer doesn't notice. Scrumpy's like that.
Scrumpy really is like that, for anybody who's not had it. It's fantastic stuff. We're talking proper British scrumpy here, not the New Zealand weird, horrible
Well, if
stuff.
It fizzes, it's not scrumpy.
No. If it dissolves straight through, you know, any tin,
yeah,
it's scrumpy.
It's scrumpy.
Yep.
If you can see through it, it's not scrumpy.
If your legs still work, it's not scrumpy.
If you can remember having drunk it, it's not scrumpy.
A fun little story here is Douglas Adams, who wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, actually came up with the idea while lying very, very inebriated in an English field, having partaken of rather too much cider that night.
I got engaged once because of scrumpy.
Fair enough. All right.
We all have scrumpy damage stories.
We really do. Okay, so there's that one. We'll also just chat quickly. Oh, yeah, this is quite cool. So this is from Ken Parrott, who writes the Open Parachute blog on SciBlogs. And it's more of a heads up than anything else to a competition being run by the Otago University's Center for Science Communication. And it's a Twitter competition. And the entry is limited to, I think you get one tweet, and you've got to explain the origins of the universe, which sounds like dead good fun. So deadline is Tuesday the 15th of November. I'm going to immediately start thinking about things to send in.
The origins of the universe in 140 characters or less. Can it just be a bit.ly to an animation that I do?
Oh my, there's probably a pun about like bit.ly, stuff.ly, you know, feed.ly, God knows. That would be pretty cool. I'm having a look at some of the tweets coming in at the moment, if you go onto the Center for Science Communication website. Okay, some people are sending in silly ones, but... wow. In fact, peering back through time, our clues, starlight dust and the movement of galaxies to try and play it all forwards again. That's interesting. Then Wyrith, nothing, nothing, wow, everything.
You don't need 140 characters.
I
can do it
so.
In two words.
Yeah, but tell
stuff
us.
Happened.
Indeed. So we'll look forward to seeing who wins those. You can go and vote for your favorite as well if you don't want to submit anything, but submit. Tweet competitions are fun. And then the last SciBlog blog post we'll chat about is a post by Alison Campbell. She writes BioBlog. And this is called Visualizing a Curriculum. And very briefly, she goes beautifully into sort of the thought processes around it. Is she's realized that possibly the course curriculum, the syllabus that they hand to students, which are often very text-heavy, they use a lot of technical terms, they're written by people who know the material inside and out, the teachers. She's realized that a lot of students may actually be baffling to understand them and to understand their relevance because they don't know about the subject. It's why they're taking the course.
Well, they're written by a generation who was raised on linear books with lots of words in.
Yeah.
Also by a generation who put a lot of value on being able to write long-winded, very, very, you know, technical things. Yeah, the more complex they could make it, the higher they would vote themselves up the science ladder to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And here we are in a generation where the web has taken us the other way in our writing. Simple writing now is seen as a value. Mm. And we have media which can be hyperlinked, so we don't have to explain everything. We can just simply leave links.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have other ways of explaining things which give context. We could put this data together into a mind map, for instance, to show connection and context. And there's so much better ways of presenting information these days. You can make it move, you can bring it to life.
Mm.
And seeing as a picture can paint 1,000 words, you can cut thousands and thousands of words out.
Precisely. So Alison is going to look at designing a syllabus, a course outline for her students that is more visual. That's going to be more about a concept map sort of idea.
Mm.
And there will be links, obviously, to other things. And the idea will be that it'll explain to the students not only what the course is all about, but also how it all fits together, how it links to material they've already learned into future courses. So they're going to get a far more, I'm going to use the word holistic, a far more holistic understanding of where the course, in New Zealand they call it a paper, where the paper fits into their general education, which I think is brilliant.
This sounds very like the small chunk of the Khan Academy, which has been codified into a two-way learning process thing. Khanacademy.org is an excellent site for learning primarily maths, but many, many other subjects now. There's over 2,500 videos there that Salman Khan has put up himself.
Wow.
But what's really cool is there's a series of about 50 or 60 exercises to start teaching you maths, and it's all laid out in a tree form, and it starts with addition.
Nice.
And then you start, you know, you start learning how to subtract, then multiplication. It's well worth looking at the alternative method for multiplication that he gives as a paper and pencil method, because it's way better than what we were taught at school.
Fascinating.
When it initially launched, they had a very simplistic method of determining when you could move on to the next unit, and that was if you could get 10 in a row right. The concept behind it is that you're showing mastery. And that until you've mastered something, you shouldn't move on, because if you do, you're less likely to understand the next thing and the next thing.
Absolutely. But that's a constant problem in maths, with people not having good foundations, and then they fall over later, and it's too late to fix it, and then suddenly they think they crap at maths and they crap at numbers.
So what this has done is it allows the pupil to see what they've got ahead of them, a network of things that are all interconnected. You can't learn X without having learned Y and Z beforehand. Mm-hmm. So you get to see where you are within this tree. It's a bit like the skills dependency in civilization or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think over the next few years, what we're going to see is a codifying of all knowledge into a tree like that, showing all the dependencies so people can see where they are. They can view a network of knowledge and go, oh, I know that small chunk there. And it gives a sense of scale, a sense of context, which you never really get when you just fed textbook after textbook in that old-fashioned way.
Absolutely. And you don't understand, you know, if I decided that I wanted to know X, Y, Z without a good understanding of how it all fits together, it's very possible to go down the wrong road, or not to get there at all, or not to understand.
Or to misunderstand.
Or to misunderstand.
To really badly misunderstand.
Which we see a lot with science as well.
Mm.
Mm. So yes, that basically is most of our discussion for today. I'll just quickly go through a couple of the events that are coming up this week. What have we got? There's the Otago International Health Research Network Conference in Dunedin this week. That should be interesting if you're into that sort of thing. There is the New Zealand Coastal Society annual conference is happening at the moment. That's in Tahuna Beach Holiday Park in Nelson. Awesome.
They'll be having a nice time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Then there are a couple of talks. There's Emily Parker's Wonderful World of Enzymes at Auckland.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
That would be great. Enzymes are just the most phenomenal proteins. They're responsible for doing everything.
Are they your favorite protein?
One of my favorite classes of protein, absolutely. I got all sort of starry-eyed about them. For anybody who doesn't know, I used to study microbiology, so I spent a fair amount of time with them. There's also the Marie Curie lecture, The Light Fantastic, by Dr. Catherine Simpson. That's at the University of Canterbury, and so she's going to be talking, going to be talking about light, and converting light into a form of energy that we can use very easily. So that should be fascinating.
Yeah.
get down to that if you have any chance to. What have we got? Then there's Death Studies in Aotearoa, New Zealand. That's in Hamilton on Friday. It sounds cheerful, but interesting. And
I thought for a second that I misheard that for a second as Death Star Studies.
And then,
which, once again, pointing lots of lasers in one small space.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got full circle.
Mine, I'm thinking of a completely unrepeatable joke that was doing the rounds this week. I'll tell Kelvin afterwards, with featuring a Death Star and stuff. It's very silly, but probably not appropriate for this. Then there's also, later in the week, there's a conference on music therapy, which is also a pretty interesting field. It's not one I know much about, but it does seem to be pretty valid.
Well, I know very little about it on an intellectual level, but on a personal level, one of my only forms of true stress relief is banging the snot out of drums.
I think it works that way for a lot.
Playing guitar really, really loud. And it does it. It's one of the few really emotional releases that a geek gets.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't go out and hit stuff or, you know, play rugby. Well, you can, but it's unusual. Many people don't want to. Right, well, that concludes us for the day. I'll say thank you to Kelvin for coming along this week.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure. And thank you to the Science Media Center for the use of their gear, and to Ruin Sheehan for the use of this music. Goodbye. Check out the episode links on cyblogs.co.nz/TOSP, and we'll chat next week. Bye-bye.